today we're going to talk about whether free will is an illusion. And the means by which we'll do it is to first have some distinctions, define some terms about what free will means, what it may or may not be consistent with. There you have those on page one of your handout. Next, we'll give an argument for why free will isn't consistent with being determined in your actions. But otherwise, if something determines you to do what it is that you do, then you're not free in that instance. And then we'll turn to Thomas Aquinas, and we'll see the sort of argument he gives for why he does think we have free will. He never, as far as I know, considers the question whether or not free will is an illusion. But he does ask the question whether we have free will. And I suppose if the answer to that was no, that's a good reason to think that the seeming that we do is an illusion. So it's the closest I think you can get in his writings to it. But he's got a nifty argument, and we'll talk about that argument. It's on page two of your handout, some reasons to support the premises of the argument as well. The general method is an analytic philosophy method. We'll be presenting the argument clearly, numbered lines, if this, then that, and if the other thing, then a third thing. We'll be giving defenses for each of those premises. So that's the plan. That's what we'll be doing here. Take a look, then, at your handout, and you'll see on the top, section A, some definitions. The first one is a definition of determinism, and that's the thesis that the past plus the laws of nature entail any future state of the world. You can think about it like this. It's a thesis that if you stop time, say God stops time and rolls it back, so to speak, a half hour, everything will happen exactly how it happened this first time around. And if you were to stop time 100 times in a row and roll it back a half hour each time when you hit play again and started going again, the same things would happen again. The idea is that things are all determined, and they're determined by how the world was before. Now, this is typically seen as problematic for freedom. If you were determined by all previous things, that you would, in fact, be free in your future actions. And we'll see an argument for that in just a sec. But before that, one distinction between views of free will. And you'll see these on your handout, too. They're called libertarianism and compatibilism. Now, the libertarian is somebody who says we do have free will, and determinism is false. And the other one is a compatibilist, and you can tell by the name, he thinks that free will and determination are compatible with each other. Okay, so what I want to do first, before we begin with Aquinas' argument, is just give us some reason for thinking that compatibilism is false. And part of the reason for giving that argument against compatibilism is it makes our question too easy. It makes the is free will an illusion too easy to answer if compatibilism were true. Here's why I think that. The main reason people think free will seems to be an illusion is that it seems like our actions might be determined by previous activities, like the way the world was before. And if that were the case, and if compatibilism were true, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. If free will and determination are compatible, and we're determined, it doesn't show us anything about whether we're free. So to make the case a bit harder for us, I think it's a good idea for us to look at libertarianism, the view that if determination were true, it'd be problematic for our freedom. Okay, look at the argument in section B. It goes like this. If determinism is true, then how the world was a billion years ago, plus the laws of nature, entail everything that I do. And, secondly, if how the world was a billion years ago, plus the laws of nature, entail everything that I do, then I have no control over what I do. And thirdly, if I have no control over what I do, then I'm not free. And so, from those three claims, if determinism is true, then I am not free. You see how that follows. It's sort of a domino effect. The argument form is called hypothetical syllogism. It's basically, if A is true, then B. And if B is true, then C. So if A is true, C follows, sort of logically. That's the argument. And you can see how the conclusion would be bad for compatibilism. Compatibilism says, hey, determinism is true, but you're still free. The conclusion says, if determinism is true, you aren't free. And both those things couldn't be true. It couldn't be true that we have this board here, I'll use it. This is not from me. This is the opposite of what a philosopher is competent to tell you about. This is determinism is true and you're free. That's what compatibilism says. The conclusion of this argument says, if determinism is true, then you're not free. The tilde is how cool people say not in logic. Not. And of course, this and that can't both be true. you start with this, and you can derive you're not free. And that's contradictory with the claim that you are free. So just to belabor the obvious, if we show that 4 is true, we've shown compatibilism is false. Well, why think 1 through 3 are true? To the first, it seems to follow straightforwardly from the definition of determinism. That if determinism is true, how the world was a billion years ago, plus the laws of nature entail everything I do. Just look at the definition of what determinism says. It's not about me in particular, but it's about all of us. And it's about the future states of the world that we all inhabit. So I think that the first premise is safely supported by the supposition of determinism and its definition. So I think it gets a pass. How about the second premise? If how the world was a billion years ago, plus the laws of nature, entail everything that I do, then I have no control over what I do. Well, why think that one? Here's why I think it's true. Start with me right now, and just go back 3 seconds to what I was doing previously. Now, if determinism is true, what I was doing previously entailed what I'm doing right now. Fair enough? Go back 3 more seconds, and 3 more seconds. You keep going back, and each of those states is determined by yet a prior state. And soon enough, you're at states that don't even involve me anymore. Like, prior to my conception, those states are determining the future states which involve me. And it's clear I don't have any control over what happened prior to my conception. And if those states entail the future states, then I don't have any control over the future states either, including the one right here, right now. So I think it's true that if the world a billion years ago, which I have no control over, and the laws of nature, which I have no control over, if those two things together entail this right here happening, then what sort of control would I have over this right here? How about the last premise, premise 3? Premise 3 says, if I have no control over what I do, then I'm not free. Now, I think that one is pretty clear, too. If I literally don't have control over it, it seems unjust to blame me for it or to say I should have done otherwise for it. I literally had no control over who won the election in 1980, the presidential election in the United States. I had no control over that because I was born that year and I wasn't yet politically active that year. So no shame on me. No praise to me either, I guess whichever way you see it. No praise to me or shame to me based on Reagan, yeah, becoming president in 1980. And no praise or shame to me because what could I do? I had no control over it. Wasn't under my free control. So I think if you have no control over what you do, you're not free in it. And we think similarly, too, for, like, hypnosis cases. We think the person looks silly when he clucks like a chicken when he's been hypnotized. But we probably shouldn't say shame on you for clucking like a chicken if you're hypnotized. If you put something in my drink that makes me go unconscious, no shame on me for going unconscious, right? So if it's outside your control, it's not something you're free in doing. Now, those three claims together logically entail the truth of 4. And 4, we said, is incompatible with compatibilism. Probably a better way to say that than incompatible with compatibilism, but I think you see what I mean. And so I think this gives us a good argument for thinking compatibilism is false. It's not the case that you can be free and determined in what you do. So that's the first step. I think compatibilism is false. There's an argument for it. But I said before, suppose you disagree with the argument. Suppose you think one of those premises is false. It's still good of us to assume compatibilism is false, because compatibilism, were it true, makes it much easier to answer our problem that we're facing, whether free will is an illusion. Okay, now we turn to Thomas Aquinas. This is, for those who have handouts, this is on page 2 of the handout, the front still, just the second side, the right-hand side. Does anybody need a handout? I think there's still some back there if somebody needs one. No? Okay, I know it's kind of late to be asking if you need one, but better late than never, I suppose. Let's look at what Aquinas says. How does he approach it when he asks whether or not we're free? Well, he focuses not on whether previous states of the world entail future states. He focuses on whether they causally necessitate future states. And by causally necessitate, I just mean the pushing and pulling of causation, like something causally speaking behind you causes you to do what you do in the future. That's what he's worried about. Because if he thinks that you're causally compelled to your actions, then you're not free in your actions. And so he wants to show that you're not causally compelled. How does he do it? Well, let's look at what he says. First, he thinks that the will the thing we're talking about, the free will. He thinks the will is an ability, or what he sometimes calls it a faculty. It's a thing by which you do stuff. It's a power, like the power of seeing or the power of smelling. Now, the will and the intellect are both what he calls rational capacities. They're parts of the human reasoning aspect of you. And he says there's a difference between the two. The intellect is aimed at what's true. Its goal is to discern truth. And the will, on the other hand, is aimed at the good. Its goal is to choose good and choose against evil. Even when you choose lousy things, even Aquinas says when you choose to sin, there's still some good that you're choosing that sin for. Suppose you choose, say, the sin of drunkenness. You're going to go out and get drunk tonight after this talk. I'm going to need it after this talk. You're going to go out and get drunk after this talk. And you choose it as drunkenness. In that case, you're choosing it for the sake of some good, likely pleasure. Likely you see there's some pleasure involved in drunkenness, and so I'm going to get drunk for the sake of some pleasure. There's still a good there, though, even if it's something really deplorable. I mean, use your own example of something really vicious you can do to somebody. That's still chosen under the aspect of some good. You see some good in doing that terrible thing to the other person. Maybe they deserve it, and you're going to punish them for it. So he says this is the guise of the good. You always choose something under the appearance of some good or other. Now, I mention this because just like the intellect is aimed at deciding what's true or figuring out what's true, the will is aimed at choosing what's good. And the question is that will free when choosing to choose what's good? Well, since it's an ability, since the free will is an ability, he thinks there are two ways you can affect the will and its choosing. Just like any other ability, there's two ways to affect it. You can affect it by affecting the person with the ability, affecting him or herself. And that's what he calls subjective affection. There's a definition on your sheet there. Subjective affection is when an ability is affected due to a change occurring in the one who has the ability. Subjective affection influences whether or not the subject performs the act, and also whether the subject does it well or poorly. Think of subjective affection as affecting the thing with the power. I have the power to see, and you subjectively affect me in my seeing when you affect the apparatus by which I see. There's objective affection, too. That's where you don't change the person with the power. You change the thing the power acts on. So there's a definition of that, too. When an ability is affected by means of a change in its object, objective affection influences what sort of action one performs. And we can think of examples here. So suppose, for argument's sake, I go to the doctor and he gives me those drops that dilate my pupils so he can check my eyes. In that case, you're not supposed to drive afterwards, right? Because things look all blurry and you have to wear those really cool glasses for a while. In that situation, you can see it's subjective affection. You're affecting the subject and how he or she, he in this case, how he uses his eyes, whether he uses them well or poorly. Objective affection, think of this. You're babysitting your relative's kids, and you're listening to a song on the radio in the car as you drive, and you realize, uh-oh, there's a bad word coming up soon in this song, and I definitely don't want my sister to think I'm showing her children lots of bad words while I watch her kids. So you turn down the radio, and you're singing along with it right at the right point. You turn down the radio, turn it back up like nothing happened. If you're a parent of 5 kids, you are a pro at this game, turning down the radio just in time. In that case, if you think about it, that's objective affection. I'm not affecting their ears. I'm affecting the object that their ears hear. By turning down the radio, I'm changing the thing that's heard, not the hearer. Think about this. You're watching those same kids, and you're watching a movie with them, and you remember, uh-oh, bad scene coming up in this movie. In that case, you might cover the eyes of the kid. And if you do that, we can ask ourselves again, is that subjective or objective affection? And here it's kind of tricky, because I suppose it depends. If you put your hand right in front of his face and his eyes stay open, well, in that case, you're affecting what he sees. He's seeing a hand instead of whatever you're covering up on the screen. But if you really clamp it down real hard and the kid, you know, closes his eyes, it's subjective affection because you're causing the subject not to use the power. When the guy closes his eyes, he's not using the power of sight. There's lots of other examples we can give here, too, of ways of affecting the subject or ways of affecting the object, the thing that the subject works on. And I belabor it now just because Aquinas thinks these are the only two ways you're going to affect somebody else's power. you're going to affect my sight by affecting my eyes or maybe stuff in my brain that controls how I process my sight. Or you're going to affect my sight by turning off the lights. If he can show that the will isn't compelled to its act, either subjectively or objectively, and those are the only two ways to force the will to do something, then you can show that your will isn't compelled to its action at all. You see what I mean? There's only two ways you can do it. Neither one does it. Then you can show that it doesn't happen. And that's the sort of argument he's going to use here. You can see I have a little quotation from him there. He says, "Therefore, in order to show that the will is not moved necessarily, we need to consider the movement of the will, both regarding performance of the will's act," that's movement with regard to the subject, "and regarding specification of the act," that's movement with regard to the object, which is by the object. So here's how I take the argument to go. He only discusses, I think, this argument in one place. It's a set of disputed questions on evil. It's got some great questions in the disputed questions on evil. Evil always seems so much more interesting than good, doesn't it? Like, I bet you might have read The Inferno by Dante, but lots of folks don't make it all the way through to the Paradiso. You know, when the monks are all dancing together, it's a little bit less boring than Alexander the Great being in boiling lava up to his nose. That's a little bit more enticing to read. So in that disputed questions on evil, he talks about this question, and he gives this argument. At least that's what I think the argument goes like. It's in the bottom of the second page. If the will is compelled to its act, then it is compelled objectively or subjectively. But he says the will is not compelled subjectively, and it's not compelled objectively, and so it's not compelled at all, not compelled to its act. And you see the form is just what I mentioned earlier. There's only two ways to force the will to do something, changing it or changing its object, and neither one does it, then you can't force the will, is the idea. And if the will isn't forced, then free will isn't an illusion, it's something really there. Okay, the question becomes, why think those premises are true? We saw in the previous argument, you know, you give the argument, you make sure it's formally valid, the premises show the conclusion to be true, and then you ask whether the premises are true or not, and get some reasons why. All right, look what he says here. Concerning premise 5, that the will, if the will is compelled to act, then it's compelled objectively or subjectively. Well, there I've already said, it's compelling is a type of affecting something, and there are only two ways to affect a power. So if the will is going to be compelled, it's going to be compelled in one of those two ways. In other words, I think the first premise, premise 5 of this argument, I think it gets a pass. I think it's true. Now let's consider premise 6. Here, it says the will is not compelled subjectively to its act. And our question at this point should be twofold. Well, what subjectively affects the will? And does that thing, whatever it is, does it compel the will? Because if we say yes to both, or if we say first, this is what affects the will and it compels, you've got a problem. All right, so what does subjectively affect the will? Here's what Aquinas thinks. Aquinas says the will is subjectively affected by its own self. Here's the idea. Suppose you go to the restaurant and you have the menu and you're talking to people, so you're not really paying attention to the menu. And then the server comes over and says, "Hey, what you want?" And you think, "Oh, shoot, I didn't yet figure it out." You say, "Come on, stupid, focus on the menu, figure it out." That's your will, basically telling your will to get to work, right? You're telling yourself, "Gotta stop doing this, I gotta do that. I gotta choose what I want to eat." He thinks that's the main way that our will is subjectively affected, through its own self, causing itself to do something. Now, does the will compel itself in that way? Does the will force itself to do something? Well, here he says, in a sense, yes and no. Here's what the will does. You can will yourself to will something, but he says your will can't force itself to will something. Your will can say, "Choose something," but he thinks the will can't say, "Choose something and also choose this very thing and you have to. I'm compelling you to do it." And that's a little tricky, I think, saying those things together. The will can't compel the will to choose this particular option. But then I think of cases. So I don't know, has anybody in here a runner or tried to start being a runner at some point? I have tried to be a runner a couple times. In fact, once I succeeded at being a runner, I was in a competition with my friends. I find one of the only ways that motivates me to do things is beating my friends at doing that thing. So we started a running competition to see who could run the most. And hot dog, I beat those people at running the most. But that's beside the point. The point is this. There are mornings, the alarm goes off at 5:30, and you think to yourself, the last thing in the universe I want to do right now is get out of this bed and go run in the cold streets. I'm from Minnesota. The streets are always cold. I don't want to get up and go run in the cold streets. In that situation, you know the feeling. You're laying in bed, and you think, come on, you can do this. Just get up, please. You can do this. The will does not compel the will. You know, like, I've laid there many a times thinking, get up, 1, 2, 3, go. And went back to sleep. So we know the will doesn't necessitate the acts of the will. Because it tries, and it fails. And it's not just with running. Think of every vicious inclination you've ever had. Everything you've thought to yourself, I'm not good in this way, and I wish I were better in this way. Think of all the times you said in your heart, damn it, this is the last time. I'm not doing this again. Secondly, well, first thing I said there was, the will doesn't really compel. We know because we've experienced the will not compelling us to action. Yes, please.
Okay, so the argument could be made that, yes, you sort of want to get up, but you more want to stay in bed.
Yeah, that's true.
So, that's what you really want. You might, be telling yourself, you should get up, I wish I could get up,
yep.
But in your heart of hearts, what you really want to do is stay in bed.
Yeah, totally.
Following that.
Yep. I think the question there is, what I'm asking here is, does the act of the will force the action in question? And here, the act of the will that I'm discussing is the one that says, get up now. Now, you're right, there might be an underlying one.
So, I would say that the act of the will does force it.
Uh-huh.
But really what you want is to stay in bed, and that's what's forcing you to stay in bed.
Oh, so I have maybe two acts of will here. An explicit one which says get up, and then the implicit subconscious one, dude, just stay in bed. It's so much better in every way. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that's doing the compelling. Yeah. How would you tell? How would you tell at least one act of will then doesn't compel? Because there's one.
Especially thinking about your example with running or something.
Yeah.
I know whenever I decide not to exercise, I know that's what I wanted to do more. Usually, maybe the easier option, the one that requires less work, is the one that you want to do more. I think you know it. You might be proud of yourself after you go for a run, but right in that moment, what you wanted to do more and what you were, that will that was forcing you was to stay in bed.
Yep. Good. I agree with all of that. And in fact, sometimes when I do praise myself afterwards, it's precisely because I had to fight an uphill battle against my own passions to get out of that bed. Passions in the Thomistic sense, just my urges, not passionate in the contemporary sense, like a romance novel. Yeah, so I see the point. Good. Well, how about, we'll come back. Certainly, it sounds like you guys have questions on the second premise six, and I think that's a good place to push. Let me get the rest of the justification for the other premises out, and then we'll come back, we'll circle back in the Q&A for it too. So, consider premise seven. The will is not compelled objectively to its act. Aquinas again asks, what's the thing that objectively compels the will? Sorry, what's the thing that objectively affects the will? Secondly, does that thing compel the will to a particular action? And his idea here is that the thing that compels the will, the thing that subjectively affects the will, is the intellect. Oh, I said subjectively. Erase what I just said. I meant objectively. It's right there in premise seven. I just misspoke. What's the thing that objectively affects the will, and does that thing compel it? The intellect is what he thinks objectively affects the will. And here's why. Consider you're back in the restaurant. You're looking at the menu. You're trying to choose what to eat. On Aquinas' view, here's how the cognition looks. You see the options before you, and you weigh the pros and cons of each. So you think to yourself, I can get the pasta. Lots of carbs and pasta. I don't know. You can get the chocolate cake and just forego dinner altogether. That's a lot of calories in it. So, but you're weighing the pros and cons there. And then, on Aquinas' picture, your will, so to speak, gets offered by the intellect. Well, here are four options. Here are the good-making qualities of this one. Here are the bad-making qualities. Here are the good making qualities of these other ones. Here are the bad making qualities. And then it's up to your will to determine which things it's more pulled to. I want that one. Give me the carbs. Who cares? That's the idea. So what affects the object of the will? What affects the thing that the will acts on? The will acts on the goods it's choosing between. And it's the intellect that tells the will what the goods are it's choosing between. Okay. Does that compel? That's the second question here. We know it's the intellect doing the objective affection. Does the intellect compel? And he says, only in a sense, but not really. Here's what he means. If the intellect presents something that's good in some ways, but not in all ways, the will can focus on the ways in which it is not good, and so not choose in light of those facts. Like, for instance, the chocolate cake. It's delicious, but it's got a lot of calories. And the will might focus, you know, the pleasures of eating it, that experience is not worth the woe to my waistline that it would cause. Maybe the will would focus on the calories and not the pleasure. So if it's not good in all ways, the will can focus on those bad ways and not choose in light of that, according to Aquinas. How about this? If the intellect, this is B now, by the way, on page 3. If the intellect presents something that is good in all ways, for instance, happiness, the will is still able, according to Aquinas, to choose to cease deliberating rather than to choose that thing. That's something you're able to do. For instance, even if a class schedule looks better than all rival options in all relevant ways for next spring semester, you might still put off choosing it until a bit later. That is, the intellect doesn't force the will to its act, though it might say this is the very best option in every single way for you now. Now, I just learned that you people here at Brown, you have a shopping season, is that what it's called, like at the beginning? This sounds bonkers to me. I've never been at a place that has a shopping spree, or whatever you people call it, for the first 2 weeks. But it sounds really hard to be a professor and not know how many students you're going to have in your class. I would never want to assign any work in the first 2 weeks, because why would I want to grade like 80 papers if 40 of those students are going to go to some other class? I think the person probably lied to me. I don't think this is really how you guys function here, because it sounds bonkers to me. So maybe this isn't a good example to you, because maybe the class schedule you look at is like 14 classes on it, and that's a crazy class schedule for anybody to have. But at other normal schools, this example would work just fine. Okay, how about C then? If the intellect presents something that is good in all ways, and the will makes an act of choosing, then the will is determined to pick. Better to say, instead of determined, say it will pick the best option. In such a case, though, the will is still free not to make an act at all, and so it still has alternate positions or options open to it. Generally, what we're getting at here is this. The question is, given that we know the intellect for Aquinas is a thing that objectively affects the will by presenting the will with its options, given that's the way the world works, is there anything the intellect does in any sort of case that requires the will to choose this thing right now? Does it make the will do the act of choosing? And he's going through options. Well, what if it's good in some ways and bad in other ways? What if that's what the intellect provides? Well, there, it's clear that the will doesn't say, gotta choose it, can't do anything but choose it, because the will can focus on the ways it's bad. He says bad or just unsuitable, too. There are some things that are good, but just unsuitable for the time you're at. I mean, think of singing a song. Think maybe you're here with your special lady friend or your special gentleman friend, and you thought to yourself, I'm going to write a song for my beloved, and I'm going to use this time here in the Q&A to sing it to my beloved, to show how much I love her. Maybe that's what you thought. And maybe none of your friends could talk you out of it. They're all like, that's a god-awful idea. Why don't you not do that? And you're like, no, I think it rhymes well, and it's emo. Do you guys know what emo is? Was that still a thing? That was a thing when I was younger. Some of you were like, what? It's emotional music. Anyway, the point here I'm making isn't so much about emo. The point here I'm making is this. Even if the thing looks good in lots of ways, and so help me, that doesn't. I'm just telling you as a friend, that doesn't look good in lots of ways. Even if you judge it as looking good in lots of ways, it might still be unsuitable. And so unsuitability is sufficient for your will to choose against it too. Not doing that. I'll do it later. Yeah, I'll do it later. Like 9 o'clock tonight after dinner. Then I'll get on my knee and take out my guitar. Then I'll sing the song to her. I say Godspeed, man. Do it. Yeah.
But is it the will that determines suitability, or is it the intellect?
That's a good question. And for Aquinas, it's the intellect. Yeah. It says, I judge to be true that this is good in these four ways. And then not good in the suitability way. Please.
So I guess, what about a case where there's one neutral slash good option, and the other ones are all really terrible,
yeah.
Right? And you have to make a decision because there are external constraints, right? Like, mm-hmm. you're about to be eaten by a tiger, so you have to either run or stay in place. There aren't really other options, right?
Yeah.
So then, do you really have the free will to make a choice there?
Mm-hmm. So in that sort of case, Aquinas considers a case that's not tigers, but it's a case where he's following Aristotle here. He says, suppose you're on a boat and it's starting to capsize, and you have your merchandise on the boat. And it's, of course, terrible for you to get rid of your merchandise. At the same time, though, you might well drown if you don't lighten the boat. And so the means by which you lighten the boat is by throwing off the merchandise and watching it sink to the wavy sea. He says in that sort of situation that there's less volitional control. What he means is you're less in control of the situation, you're less blameworthy for the situation, because there are these extenuating circumstances that are acting on you. And because of those circumstances, one, you're less in your right mind. You know, if you're in terror, you're less in your right mind, and so you're less blameworthy for what you do. But secondly, you're weighing the goods, and the good of your life far exceeds the good of the merchandise. So in those cases, he says the will is still acting, because you still make a choice, but your blameworthiness or praiseworthiness is diminished because of the extenuating circumstances.
I guess the thing is that if there's like an option that's good always, right, and you know, the will could still choose to do nothing, it seems like that's not always true. So it feels like there's a case here that isn't really enumerated, like within the sub, like ABCDE.
Uh-huh. And the case here is, describe it one more time.
Also, so like, I guess the case where you have multiple options. One is clearly the best slash, you know, it's good in all ways or whatever.
Yeah.
And you have constraints such that you have to choose, like, within the next couple of seconds or whatever, right?
Yep. For Aquinas, the only thing that's going to be good in all respects is the end of happiness for a human. And so it's not going to be a particular means, it's going to be an end. That's the thing that's good in all respects. And so for him, like your example is good with the tiger because you only have two means, right? But it's not going to be a case where it's good in all respects. Even in the tiger case, I don't even know. Like, there are two types of bears, I think, in the United States, and one you're supposed to act really large and scream at, and the other one you're supposed to play dead with. And by golly, I never keep them straight. I live in Minnesota where there are bears. I mean, not near me, I'm in the Twin Cities, but I always think to myself when we're hiking, if I find a bear, I don't know, I'm going to say to my wife, you lay down over there and play dead. I'm going to scream over here, and we're going to figure out which one of us dies, which one of us is right about the situation. So ignorance itself can preclude you from knowing which is the best route to. All right, and I think we're at E here. Speaking of the necessity, oh, no, I was at D, sorry. In short, the most the intellect can do, according to Aquinas, is determine a particular object of choice, which the will cannot choose against. But the intellect cannot force the will to perform its act of choosing. Here's the idea. The will can say, this is it, man. This is the best thing. I consider it every way, backwards and forwards. This is it. But the will can't, but the intellect can't also say, so pick it. So do it. Do it. I mean, the choosing is an act of the will, not the act of the intellect. The intellect adjudicates, but doesn't choose. And so it doesn't have the oomph to force. Doesn't have that sort of power, according to Aquinas. So that's the end of the justification for premise 7. The premise which states, you go back to my premises there, that the will is not compelled objectively to its act. And so we're at a good place to derive 8. Look, if it's only affected in one of two ways, and it's not compelled to its act in either of those two ways, then it's not going to be compelled at all. That's the conclusion anyway. And I've seen you guys have done some nice jobs of pushing on the premises. The first premise I think should get a pass because I think it seems pretty true. But the next two are the ones that hold all the weight for making the argument work. And that's why you guys are trying to chip away at those premises. All right, one final bit before we get to the end of the talk. And it's about this. There are multiple ways to argue for or against something. One way to argue for a position is to enumerate the good-making qualities it has. Another way to argue for that same position is to argue about the bad-making qualities its opponents have. You see this in politics all the time. In fact, that's primarily what we see in politics, isn't so much arguing for my positions being the best. It's saying that guy's positions are like Hitler on a bad day. That's what that guy's positions are like. So what we see here with Aquinas is he considers some reasons for why if free will were an illusion, that'd be really bad for things that we think are true. And here's two that he gives. Now, your mileage may vary, as the saying goes, depending on whether or not you think heterodoxy is an important thing to avoid. But for Aquinas, it is. So the first reasoning goes like this. That humans can merit or earn things, his example here is you can earn your own damnation, is a central and orthodox part of the Christian story. But if our acts are really unfree, then humans cannot merit or earn anything. Thus, if our acts are all unfree, then a central and orthodox part of the Christian story is false. So you see how that works there. The general idea is, if you really don't have control over it, if it's really not under your control, you're not free, then you can't be praised or blamed. You don't merit anything for it. If some nefarious neuroscientist programs you to help me, to give me $10, say, and then you do it, not from your own free will, but just because he pushed the right buttons on his joystick to make you give me the $10. You don't deserve any praise for that. I mean, you could have made a robot, you know, and used the robot with the same joystick to get me the $10, and we wouldn't praise the robot. So likewise, we shouldn't praise you. And if you did the same thing and you programmed you to punch me, and then you punched me after the talk, which I'd encourage you not to do, that'd be sad. But if you were to punch me after the talk, and you were really programmed to do so by a nefarious neuroscientist, we shouldn't blame you either. I might blame you at first, say, man, that was really rude. But then I'd look behind you, and I'd see the guy with the controller, and I'd say, ah, he's the guy I blame, not you. You're just an unwitting accomplice. So no praise or blame, no merit or demerit, if unfree, is the idea here. And a second reason. He says that the denial of freedom destroys moral philosophy. That sounds a bit hyperbolic, but I see what he means. Here's a quotation from him. These are the things that he's talking about. Deliberation, exhortation, precept, punishment, praise, and blame. He thinks all of those go out the window if you get rid of freedom. But if our actions are all unfree, then none of those elements are intelligible. Thus, if our actions are all unfree, then moral philosophy is destroyed. Here's the idea. Like I said before, you can't blame me for things that are outside my control. And I oughtn't blame you for things that are outside your control. And if determinism is true and everything you do is unfree, then nothing's really in your control. That's what follows. I shouldn't blame or praise you for anything. And consider how deliberation would work. Suppose you really thought that you weren't free. Suppose you really thought that it's already decided, so to speak, what you'll do in the future. And there's only one thing decided. It just will be this that you'll do. In that case, it's weird to think of deliberating. Like, what are you deliberating about? What you'll do? Well, no. I mean, you already believe that's settled. There's nothing you could do to change what you're going to do. So deliberation seems like a weird thing. Or how about precept? I say, don't steal things. And you say, okay, I won't. Well, if you're determined to, and it's not under your control, and you're unfree, what's the point of me exhorting you not to steal things? So his thought here is then that lacking freedom, moral philosophy, and morality in general lacks a ground, lacks a necessary condition it needs. Okay, so in conclusion then, what have we done? We've seen three definitions of relevant terms. Termination, or determinism, libertarianism, and compatibilism. We've seen an argument that I think is good, but you guys can question, about whether or not compatibilism is false. The argument says compatibilism is false. We next saw Aquinas and what subjective and objective affection are, what they amount to, and his claim that those are the only two ways to affect a power or a faculty. Since the will is a power or faculty, is going to be affected, if it is at all, in one of those two ways. The question is just, the ways it's affected, did those compel? And we've seen his reasoning for why they don't compel. And so, since there's only two ways to affect it, neither one compels, the will isn't compelled. And if uncompelled, then at least that main reason people think free will is an illusion, that you're really compelled to your actions, that reason wouldn't be a good reason. And then we saw at the end two final consequences he considers, not of his own view, but two consequences of his opponent's view, saying, if you go that way, you got these two problems. You're a heretic, and you might say, who cares? But also, you can't use, moral philosophy is destroyed for you. That's an unfortunate thing. We like saying people did bad things. We don't like having to say it, but it sure does feel good sometimes to say, that was wrong, and you shouldn't have done that. And we lose out on that. Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think I get what you're saying. The claim is, hey, look, it could be the case that all the choices I do make, or all the apparent choices I make, are really determined by my previous brain states, or determined by my previous situations I was in. At that point, I think the question is, we have to get the best reasons for not only it could be the case, but it actually is the case that all my previous brain states imply my future actions, and then weigh those against the reasons for thinking they don't. Yeah.
That, for example, say if you were born in a lower-income household and you came to college, unfortunately, it is true that even if you were determined to likely do better, you're likely to do less. Mm-hmm. Research indicated that you're not likely to do as good as people who come from a well-off background who aren't as exceptional. So there is indication in like research that says,
yeah,
hey, the way you grew up actually affects your choices in, you know, the future. For example, even alcoholism. If you had a parent who was an alcoholic, you're more likely to be an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to sleep in on a particular day, that's because that's likely to give you more serotonin than if you don't sleep in. And if
yep.
you say you prefer exercise, that's because you're probably an adrenaline junkie. Sorry.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, adrenaline junkie. Yeah.
So
right?
there's no reason that everything we do cannot be explained with explained with biological
yeah.
neurotransmitters and things like that.
So there's a step there that I missed. The claims were it's more likely that this than that if a certain thing happened. And I think Aquinas would and should grant the likelihood claims. You're more likely to do A if B had happened to you. I think what he'd be hesitating to grant, and what I don't know if there's literature on this, that if A happened to you, then you must, your will is compelled to choose B. The examples you gave were you're more likely to do worse in college, or you're more likely to become an alcoholic yourself. But what he would need to show compulsion is a necessity, not a mere likelihood argument. And that's what I think the jury is out on. I don't know of any good evidence that shows a necessity argument, which is what you need to show compulsion. There was another, yes, you? Yeah.
Okay. So I was wondering, a lot of the premises rely on introspection, so our understanding of how we're thinking
mm-hmm.
and how our will functions. But if our free will was an illusion, why should we trust our own introspection, our own understanding of how our mind is functioning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So suppose free will is an illusion. Then you've been duped this whole time.
Yeah.
Because it sure seems like you have free will. And if you know it's duped you once, why trust it at all?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly an argument you can give. The trick of it is it's going to prove a lot more than I think. Maybe not a lot more than you wanted to, but a lot more than I'd want to prove. Because if that's the argument we're giving, that fool me once, don't trust you again in the future, then it's going to work not only for my sense of free will, but for my memory, which is reliably wrong, you know, a lot of the time, and lots of other sorts of introspective things I have, the testimony of others that I've heard before, I've been wrong before. I just think it's too high of a bar to say if it's duped me once, don't trust, because then you wouldn't be able to trust your memory or testimony, your sight. So I see that the argument you give would work, but I think I deny the premise behind it because I think it proves too much. Sir.
Something I didn't understand in the Aquinas argument. So basically, let's take the example of the tiger, right? And it's like obvious that your intellect is telling you you must run away, but he says you might still choose not to, right?
Yeah.
So does he say what is driving will? So it's like it's very unsatisfying. There's no. We don't really. He doesn't give an idea of how will functions. What at the end of the day, what tells will? How does will decide what to do? Let's say if it's not the intellect. So
yeah, that's a good question. I think I would like this. Maybe this is the way you were thinking about it too. You have the will, and it's got two options: option one, option two. And it chooses option one, say, run from the tiger. And then the question is, why did it do that thing? How do you explain why it did its thing? Now, here's a sort of view you could have, but Aquinas would want to reject. Well, the will did that, call that will one, because of some previous act which caused that action. Or maybe just some black box, something out there that caused it. He doesn't want any of this because you're on a backwards regress. There's got to be some point where it stops. If it stops way before I was born, then I don't have freedom. So you have to stop the regress somewhere. He thinks the best place to stop it is there. And the way you say this is just say, the will chooses, and nothing forces the will to its choice. That's just the job of the will, to choose.
But the way it chooses, definitely it's not random.
Oh.
It chooses, on the basis of what? So.
Yep. So it sees the goods as apprehended by the intellect and presented to it.
Yeah.
And then it says, I want that one. And you say, why did it do that? Why didn't it do the other? And on Aquinas' view and on all libertarian views, there's no answer to that question. It's, I wanted that one, but why did you choose that one? I chose it because I wanted it. Why did you want that one? I guess there's an answer there. You know, you can tell a backwards-looking story of why you wanted what you wanted. But you're not going to get anything that necessitates this, because that's precisely the thing he doesn't want to have happen in his story. Let's see. Back here. That gentleman, and then this lady right here, please. Okay.
So, kind of follow up to your question. In this, I guess, instead of seeing it as an infinite regress, you see it as an infinite forward series of presentations of the intellect, acts of the will, and there's always that finite set of available decisions, which Christian theology of a darkened intellect.
Mm-hmm.
So think of the comment I made earlier about upbringing and neurological influences, and that we do not have a complete picture in our intellect at any given time of what absolute reality might be.
Sure, that's all true. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's all true, and I think Thomas would agree with that too. Did I just step on a landmine I didn't see?
No.
Sometimes people do that at philosophy talks. They say things that are like, you think, yeah, those are true. And he says, okay, here's a contradiction in what you just said. And he's like, ah, run. So I've learned to play it cool at philosophy talks and say, one might think that, yes. Let's see. Please, ma'am, you were next.
My question is kind of similar. It's like a two-part question.
Okay.
So the first part is, like, are we considering free will as an absolute, like a black and white issue, or is it more like an interaction? We have some choice and some, like, part is determined by chemicals and other factors. And also, if the first option is true, if it is a black and white matter, wouldn't that require the intellect to have, like, perfect knowledge and veridical perception of the world, and the will to have absolute knowledge of a very concrete of good and evil, which to my understanding is not the case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's true that there are grades and shades, both of praise and blame, and the corresponding freedom in the action for the praise and blame. The only one I can think of offhand is the Catholic Catechism talks about shades and grades of freedom and moral responsibility. In the section on masturbation, it talks about it, and it says that you can reduce the person's, or better to say, the person can have less blameworthiness and less control over the situation based on psychological history, based on other things as well. So I think, I mean, Aquinas, of course, didn't have the catechism from 1994, but I think Aquinas would agree with that as well. So to answer your question, there are grades and shades of freedom, and when you get low enough, like with the merchandise over the ship, you have less freedom, less culpability as well. Yeah. Oh, goodness. This gentleman I haven't heard from yet. Please.
So it seems to me that determinism, by definition, is like a dogmatic claim. And so I was wondering if there's any philosophical ground to which determinism could be proved at all. And if it's like even worth like debating this, mm-hmm. given that we can't like really prove anything.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, you're breaking my heart. It's true that philosophy alone will not tell you whether determinism is true. I think that's true. And in fact, I just watched a video. There's a Society of Catholic Scientists. They had a recent meeting, and there was a man from Notre Dame who spoke there and gave some physical arguments for why determinism is false based on quantum physics. I can't rehearse them to you. I don't know them well enough. But if you look at the Society for Catholic Scientists, the recent meeting, a guy from Notre Dame gave this talk. So to answer the question, no, if philosophy can't show that thing, we can show other things, man. We can prove stuff. I was going to give, like, examples, but this talk's about freedom. that's the answer to the question.
So I just want to push a little bit on Section E, which are the consequences and how those are the converse negative arguments from the other side.
Yep.
And I'm not totally sure that I buy that either of them are compelling negative arguments. So the first one seems entirely based around Christian theology.
Right? Sure.
So really only seems compelling if you have a vested interest in like saying this is compatible with Christian theology.
Yep.
It doesn't seem like coming from any other background, which most of the people in the world do, or coming from a secular standpoint, that there's any reason to believe that that proves anything, that the lack of free will is inconsistent with Christianity. The second point seems more difficult because we really like as a society to have kind of these moral ethics where we can put people in jail if they do the wrong thing or punish them or like praise people.
Mm-hmm.
But those to me all seem like practical aspects of living in a society, right? We need to be able to do those things so that society continues to function. But on a universal scale, it doesn't seem like there really is any objective morality where those things matter outside of how we want to function in our society. So again, it seems like it boils down to, we want this to be consistent with what we know and like, and is practical for us to believe, but it doesn't seem like there's this broader metaphysical necessity for those being negative things.
Yeah, good, I like that point. As I mentioned before, your mileage may vary, and so if you're not a Christian, the first argument might not work very well for you. Now, I guess Muslims also believe in individual merit and demerit. And so if you have all the Christians and all the Muslims, you're pretty far into getting lots of folks in the world.
Sure.
And, I mean, I don't know enough about other religions, too, but my hunch is individual praise and blame is important for many of them, too. But you're right. It's only going to work for people, the first argument is only going to work for people who think that merit and demerit are real things. So this is for the Thomistic Institute, though, so I think it's okay to throw in one premise from Christian theology in an argument. Maybe not. But so that's the first one. To the second one, man, I don't know. You said there seems to be no objective right or wrong. It sounds like a fictionalism. Like there isn't really a right or wrong there, but we just need it for the world to work the way we want the world to work. And that could be true. My hunch is none of us really believe that, though, when we're wronged. And it's not even that I want the world or society to work right. It's that when the guy slanders me, I think he's just done a bad thing. Like, let the society go out the window. He still did a wrong to me. Especially true when you see, like, a kid push down your kid. Oh, man, the things you want to do to that child? Because you think the child did wrong. So there I'm just saying it can't all be societal and political because some of the things we think are right or wrong aren't really societal or political.
I'm not sure I'd buy that.
Well, maybe. I mean, how about things that you've done that are wrong, and you tell yourself never again, and then you do it again, and no one else knows about it?
Sure, but the things that we believe that are wrong when we do them and we feel bad about them are because we've been brought up in a certain way to believe that certain things are right and certain things are wrong. much of the time based on religious morality.
Sure.
But from like a universal standpoint, like even setting humans aside entirely, it doesn't, there's nothing like there. And unless you believe that there is this objective or morality handed down from a higher power, which, given the setting of this talk, I imagine many people here do.
Yeah.
But if that's not the case, I don't see why this would be a problem.
It sounds like the view is the only way you get objectivity in morality is through a lawgiver who does it. And that's certainly a view, but I mean, you probably know there's lots of different ways of getting objectivity and morality without a universal lawgiver doing it. Like a Kantian ethic would give you objectivity. You might think it's false, but there's just more routes to go than just the divine command morality.
Was there a question?
That's a good question. There are arguments against, well, we normally think that randomness isn't very good for freedom anyway. Like if you want to say that you're free and the reason you're free is because it was a coin flip, that's not really giving you the sort of control that we want. So what you want here, what Aquinas wants here is not determination and not total randomness, because neither one of those is going to get you freedom. You want some sort of sweet spot in the middle where you have your own personal control over it because you chose to do it, you do it. So that's the answer. Did you think that it's tricky to get that sort of sweet spot in the middle between the two?
Yeah, I mean, because we couldn't really seem to come up with a reason for why you picked the one. Like, it doesn't seem explainable. Like, because it wasn't because of some past event, it wasn't because of somebody influencing you. It's just, like, it's just not tangible, I guess.
It's true that you can choose it influenced by what other folks tell you and by your upward bringing. But Aquinas just wants to say it's not necessitated. It's not like causally force. Like she grabs your hand and makes you hit somebody. That's causally force. You know? But there's nothing like that in the case of the will, he thinks. Okay. Please, yeah.
I just want to point out for this question, there is a field of ethics called evolutionary ethics that does, you know, explain morality without the existence of a lawgiver, and does explain morality without any need for free will whatsoever. So already with respect to the second point, you know, you have already have evolutionary ethics to explain that and explain why even if we do not have free will, we still have morals.
Yeah. In that case, I'm sure you know the field better than I do. But,
I'm not a philosopher at all, so I'm like I don't know anything, sorry.
Oh, then I'll just, here's the way it works then. No, in evolutionary ethics, I have a friend at Princeton who's a psychologist and does evolutionary ethics. So I should ask Jordan about this. But the way, when we've talked about it, it sounds like this. He's not telling me whether it's really true that I shouldn't steal things. He's telling me why we all think we shouldn't steal things. And there's an evolutionary story to tell for why societies that have that sort of implicit belief flourish better and so can propagate their genes better than societies that lack it. Now, that might tell you why we think what we think about morality. But if we're interested not only in why we think it, but whether it's true, then I think evolutionary psychology and evolutionary ethics isn't going to tell us that part.
But what is true? I mean, That's a very arbitrary, random question. What's true?
The true is that which corresponds to reality.
And but with respect to reality, whatever is helping us grow our population is what is true. So.
Oh, I see what you mean. No, I don't think so. I mean, what if you might be able to think that some really cruel, some cruel sorts of views on the part of a priesthood can propagate genes well. Maybe with his forced mating, right? Like, I'm thinking of not like Catholic priests. I'm talking about if you have a hierarchy that enforces mating for the best genes and then kills off the rest. Now, that would be, I guess, true in the sense you're using, but we'd also think bad. So you can't just, say whatever is evolutionarily best is what's best for, you can't always say what's evolutionarily is best is what's morally good because it's evolutionarily better to do lots of things that are awful.
But also, especially selecting means, you know, that also has influences evolutionary. So there's, so by forcing mates, you're probably not optimizing the genetic material that passes down. So it doesn't work. Your particular case as well.
Yeah. Is that true for like Mustangs? You know, like when they breed horses, they choose them intentionally for their power, but they're actually doing something that's detrimental to the line in doing it. Maybe not. Here's something I thought of and I forgot to say. There's a philosopher named Alvin Plantinga. He was at Notre Dame. He's retired since, and he considers the question. It sounds similar to this, maybe not the same one. The question was, is what's right just what's evolutionarily beneficial for the agent in question? And he said, well, here's a case from nearby. There was a doctor in Indiana who had a sperm bank, and they discovered that 80 or so kids were his children, not the sperm of the person it was supposed to be. Now, that guy rocked at disseminating his genes throughout the society. He's going to have so much more genetic material from him than me, and I have 5 kids, right? So, but he's way ahead of me. Now, if the claim is right, that what's right is what's conducive to propagating your genetic materials, then that guy's like the Pope, or maybe better. He's like Mother Teresa. He's like super good. He's like a super good guy. But normally we think, nah, that was a jerky move, guy. You ought to have used the sperm she wanted you to use instead of your own. So I guess what I'm saying here is there's some reason to think that sort of evolutionary view won't get us all the ethical claims we want to have.
Well, I just wanted to counter that single point as well.
That one too? You thought that guy was acting well?
Oh, no, I don't think he was acting well. But as a society, we think he was acting bad because there were other sperms that were that were more compatible. So in fact, he might have succeeded in spreading his genetic material.
Yeah.
However, from the point of view of society, that wasn't the most optimal thing to do.
Oh, I see what you mean. So the claim I gave was, what's right for me to do is what propagates my genes. And you said, that's the wrong claim.
It's
what's right for me to
society.
Do is what propagates society's genes. Yeah.
Whatever is likely to... So evolutionary ethics indicates whatever is best for society as a whole. So, you know, that's why we have... You know, soldiers going out to war because we think that's what's best for society.
Sure.
They won't get to propagate their genes, but because they make that sacrifice, there are other members of society who might.
That's a good point. I think with a little bit of tweaking of the case to make it not real but fictional, he's doing the right, he's propagating somebody's genes best, but he's tricking ladies to do it the whole way through. You still get the same sort of case, and we have the propagation the way you'd want it, so it's spread out appropriately. But it's still by corruption and deceit. We'd still think that's bad.
We are out of time for questions. So thank you all for coming. If we can thank Professor Paul one more time before we leave.
Thank you.